So thank you for attending session 337, titled The Relationship Between the LDS Church and the NAACP, 1918 to 2019. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in Q&A portions of this session following the remarks of the presenters. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. As you listen today, we invite you to reflect on your connection and access point to the topic. At Sunstone, we never ask anyone to adopt the opinions of others, rather to instead practice curiosity as an act of humility and empathy. Perhaps you'll find things you hear today that align with your own views, and perhaps you'll find yourself challenged by them. At Sunstone, we believe the wrestling with ideas is a critical part of learning and growth. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk in the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine, 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. The session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow everyone enough time for lunch. We invite you to purchase food from the concessions just outside or to visit outside vendors as well. A little about this session. This session is a discussion of the relationship between the NAACP and the LDS Church, which went through 4 phases. First, the LDS Church being ignorant of the existence of the NAACP. Second, contention between the two organizations. Third, cautious recognition of the existence of the two organizations. And fourth, friendly cooperation between the two organizations. Robert A. Greenwell is an independent researcher in Mormon history and last year presented a paper on Mormonism's one-drop rule and its application in regards to a devout Mormon family in Utah at last year's symposium, Sunstone Symposium. We'll now turn the time over to the presentation.
Thank you very much for the introduction. The practice of polygamy rocked the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the 19th century, and the question of priesthood ordination of black men replaced polygamy as a bone of contention in the 20th century. No teaching of the LDS Church caused more controversy, derision, disgust, and head-shaking on the part of people both inside and outside the church than the teaching barring blacks from ordination in the Mormon priesthood. Dr. Chauncey Harris, Brigham Young University's first Rhodes Scholar, a world-renowned professor of geography at the University of Chicago, and a leading American expert on the Soviet Union, wrote a letter of warning to the LDS First Presidency on November 13, 1953, in which he stated that a vast moral revolution was sweeping the United States, in which discrimination against individuals on the basis of race is diminishing with an unbelievable rapidity. The revolution was taking place in business and sports, in education, and in many Christian churches. And leaders in public thought who have embraced the ideal of non-discrimination have become impatient with groups that still maintain policies of racial bias, and they feel the urge to embark on a vigorous crusade among such groups. Dr. Harris noted that this revolution was becoming a tremendous force in parts of the United States, although it may not have been felt in Utah as yet. He urged the First Presidency to re-examine its statements and policy on the race question without delay in order to avoid the searchlight of widespread publicity and public disapproval on an issue in which will appear in an extremely unfavorable light. In a confidential letter to President David O. McKay, dated January 28, 1953, Dr. Harris urged the Mormon prophet to grant the priesthood to blacks before great harm is done to the good name of the church. President McKay, who sought guidance from the Lord on this topic on a number of occasions, replied that, of course, we must await the Lord's answer to that question. The answer came 25 years later to a different prophet, and only after harsh criticism and public demonstrations from individuals inside the church and organizations outside the church. Leading the charge outside the church in Utah was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The relationship between the LDS Church and the NAACP is the subject of this presentation, and it went through four distinct phases: non-recognition, open hostility, cautious recognition, and friendly cooperation. Following the disavowal of the active practice of polygamy, and after the Senate hearings regarding the seating of Senator Reed Smoot, the LDS Church began to enter the mainstream of American society. This was a period of rapid economic growth in the United States, and at the same time was marked by vigorous reform in many areas of politics and society. African Americans, unfortunately, were excluded from this progressive reform movement. The race problem was ignored, and the progressive era marked the low point for black people in America. Few Americans during the progressive era believed in racial equality. Nearly everyone acknowledged the superiority of the white race. This was evident in the thinking of the most important institutions and individuals in the period between 1900 and 1920. The Supreme Court of the United States in 1896, in the decision Plessy versus Ferguson, ruled that racial segregation was within the power of the states to ensure public order, and this allowed individual states to discriminate with abandon on the basis of race. Charles W. Eliot, the progressive president of Harvard University, deplored miscegenation, denounced the admixture of racial stocks, and endorsed separation of races on which Southern society was based. President of the United States Theodore Roosevelt placed African Americans at the bottom of the racial hierarchy, believing that black people were burdened by bad genes, had a sordid history, and could not be assimilated into American society. William Howard Taft, president and Supreme Court justice, despised African Americans and felt the best friend of blacks was the Southern white man. Woodrow Wilson, who courted black voters in the 1912 presidential election with the promise of fair treatment, was a Southerner born in Virginia and raised in Georgia, and held Southern views of blacks as an inferior race and thought slavery had been a civilizing process for the oppressed black people. Though not a radical white supremacist, Wilson segregated the federal bureaucracy and even screened the epic movie, The Birth of a Nation, in the White House, calling the racist theme of the film so terribly true. Mormon leaders at the time held similar views of white racial superiority and black inferiority. Their views, however, were based on peculiar LDS interpretations of scripture and Mormon views of history, including actions in a so-called pre-existent life. Largely ignored by nearly all mainstream reformers, African Americans created their own progressive movement, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in the year 1909. The NAACP was formally organized in 1910 with the stated purpose of achieving for black citizens all the rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, and to protect blacks from lynching and pillaging by white Americans. The organization began with only a few hundred members, the most important being prominent and influential white men and women in less than a dozen local branches in large cities in the eastern United States. In the wave of excitement for improvement in the well-being of African Americans brought about by World War I, and to increase funding for the NAACP, the organization instituted a membership drive in 1918 to increase its membership by 50,000 members. Called the Moorfield Story Drive, named for a prominent white attorney and first president of the NAACP, the organization attempted to grow its membership in the southern and western areas of the United States. At the same time, the NAACP was attempting to expand its membership into the Western United States. An incident of violence occurred on the streets of Salt Lake City, which led to the establishment of a branch of the NAACP in Utah's capital city. Two young African Americans, Thelma Stewart and Wallace Thurman, were walking down Main Street at 2nd South when they were attacked by a group of white soldiers from Fort Douglas. Young Thurman was knocked to the ground without provocation, and when he got up, was beaten to the ground once more. The young woman attempted to interfere, and she too was knocked down, loaded into an automobile, and spirited away by the group of soldiers. Both young African Americans suffered serious cuts and bruises. The brutal incident led to a mass meeting called by Reverend George W. Hartz, the pastor of the local Cavalry Baptist Church. At this meeting, held on April 15, 1918, a complaint was drawn up and presented to the Salt Lake City Commission, at which it was asserted that the local police had been guilty of inexcusable negligence in that they made no effort to apprehend the soldiers who had attacked the young people until sufficient time had elapsed to allow them to escape. None of the soldiers were ever apprehended. One of the most prominent African Americans in the meantime came to Salt Lake City to deliver an address. The speaker was Kelly Miller, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Dean Miller, enthusiastic, who believed at the time World War I would lead to the achievement of civil rights and greater equality for African Americans. He was welcomed with great enthusiasm by the Salt Lake African American community, and he inspired greater involvement in the pursuit of equality for black people. Reverend Hartz contacted the National Association, National Office of the NAACP, and a branch of the Civil Rights Organization was established in Salt Lake City with a total membership of 36. Other newly established branches of the NAACP organized during the Moorfield Story Drive were as follows: Sacramento, California, 51, Lincoln, Nebraska, 64, and Houston, Texas, 176. On February 10, 1919, the Salt Lake City branch of the NAACP was formally established by Reverend Hartz, who was installed as the first president with a total membership of 53. By the end of World War I, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints ceased to be viewed as a menace to the American way of life, and although it continued to be viewed as an odd belief system, the organization had achieved a degree of acceptance and even respectability. Senator Reed Smoot achieved an influential position in the U.S. Senate as chairman of the powerful Senate Finance Committee, and he served as an important advisor to Presidents Harding and Coolidge. J. Reuben Clark, Jr. was a friend and advisor to President Herbert Hoover, and he served as Undersecretary of State in the Hoover administration and was ambassador to Mexico. Senator Smoot was at the same time a member of the Council of the 12 Apostles, and Clark would become an influential counselor in the first presidency. The NAACP, on the other hand, was not a significant factor in U.S. politics and American society at the time. If the national organization was little known, the local Salt Lake City branch of the NAACP was virtually invisible. The black population in Utah at the time was much less than 1% of the total state population. The membership in the Ku Klux Klan in Utah was much larger than the African American population by 1925, and it was far more active. Klan gatherings with cross burnings were common in Utah in the early 1920s. In July 1921, five hooded masked men entered a home in Salt Lake City's west side and beat the residents into a state of unconsciousness with clubs. The police called the attack most mysterious and attributed it to a branch of the Klan, which was rumored to be organizing in Salt Lake City. More serious was the torture and lynching of the African-American itinerant miner from Arkansas, Robert Marshall, on a farm on the outskirts of Price on June 18, 1925. 11 men were arrested for the crime, nearly all of whom were known Klansmen, but after a grand jury hearing in which over 100 were interviewed, no charges could be filed against anyone. The Ku Klux Klan, known as the Invisible Empire, gradually petered away in Utah. Although many LDS were members of the Klan during the 1920s, it was dominated by Gentiles and Jack Mormon. The Deseret News, the official secular voice of the Mormon Church, labeled the Klan an insult and menace to orderly government. Sermons and statements by church leaders told LDS members to avoid secret societies, and the Improvement Era cautioned Mormons to shun the Klan. The election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to the presidency in 1932 led to a serious crisis within the hierarchy of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Initially, some leaders welcomed the new president and were enthusiastic with the new leadership. This group included the Democrat Stephen L. Richards and most notably first counselor in the first presidency, Anthony W. Ivins. President Heber J. Grant, a nominal Democrat throughout his life, opposed the candidacy of Roosevelt in 1932 on the grounds the Democratic Party platform called for the abolition of prohibition. President Grant was the leader of the Utah State Prohibition Movement. When Anthony W. Ivins passed away, J. Reuben Clark Jr. was selected to succeed him as first counselor. Now no one could stop Grant's growing conviction that Satan ruled in the White House, and the New Deal was leading the United States into apostasy and the destruction of constitutional government. Grant, Clark, and second counselor David O. McKay began an aggressive campaign against the Roosevelt administration. The passage of the Social Security Act in 1935 appears to mark the turning point when church officials mounted intense opposition to federal intervention in the effects of the Great Depression. This program of providing old age subsidies, unemployment insurance, and means-tested relief seemed to represent to the conservative members of the first presidency the first stage in the communist takeover of the United States. Government relief without work represented to them the destruction of free agency and moral deterioration, and they began to rally around free enterprise and conservative politics. It was at this time that the LDS Church rolled out its church security program in April 1936, a program designed to help the worthy poor and at the same time curtail federal relief efforts. At the same time, the church leadership encouraged LDS members to support the Republican candidate Alf Landon in the 1936 election. Roosevelt swept the election, receiving more than 69% of the vote in Utah. Heber J. Grant wanted LDS members to rise up and rebel against the Roosevelt administration, and to his dying day expressed bewilderment that Mormons could support Roosevelt in the New Deal. When war broke out in Europe in September 1939, the LDS leadership was more worried about internal New Deal threats than fascist aggression in Europe. It is no wonder, then, that such a conservative leadership would also oppose the civil rights movement when it surfaced following World War II. LDS racialist teachings, thought to have come from Joseph Smith and ultimately God, solidified this hostility to racial equality. Somehow, the NAACP branch in Salt Lake City managed to remain in existence during the Great Depression, although meetings, which were usually held in the basement of one of the black churches or in a private home, were normally attended by only a handful of members. A few months before the bombing of Pearl Harbor by the Japanese Empire on December 7, 1941, the defenses of the United States were already cranking up for war, and President Franklin Roosevelt issued an executive order calling for the end of racial discrimination in the defense industries. The state of Utah was already in the process of enlarging already existing defense installations and constructing new ones, including what came to be known as Hill Air Force Base. Railroads in the state were at the same time humming with activity. The result was the influx of new workers into the state, including a number of African Americans. Between 1940 and 1946, the African American population in Utah increased by 400%, although it was still small compared to most other states. Utah was not a hospitable place for African Americans at this time and was sometimes called the Mississippi of the West. There were no separate facilities such as drinking fountains and restrooms for blacks in Utah. There is no record of blacks being refused the right to vote. African Americans could sit where they wanted on public conveyances. And there were no segregated in schools in Utah, although black students were very frequently harassed by student and teachers alike in the public schools. Racial discrimination, on the other hand, was evident in many areas. Most restaurants, especially the better ones, refused service to black people. Public accommodations in most hotels and motels were off limits to African Americans. Bowling alleys were closed to blacks. Clubs and bars refused entrance to people of color. Blacks could only occupy the balcony at movie houses and theaters. Housing was limited to certain, usually undesirable areas, so-called dead housing zones. Most businesses refused to hire blacks. Blacks were often harassed by law enforcement officers, and the police killing of a black teenager led to the establishment of the Ogden branch of the NAACP in 1944. African Americans could usually only find employment in the most menial service jobs or undesirable, difficult, and often dangerous employment. These were all de facto restrictions. The only de jure restriction on African Americans and persons of Oriental descent was Utah's anti-miscegenation statute, originally enacted in 1888. This law prohibited race mixing between whites, blacks, and Orientals. Overshadowing this discrimination was the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the institution dominating Utah's politics, economics, religion, and society, and its teachings that African Americans descended from the biblical Cain and were inferior and cursed by God. African Americans everywhere were determined to end racial discrimination following World War II. Black Americans had supported entering the war with the goal of achieving the double V's, victory over the totalitarian empires of Germany, Italy, and Japan, followed by victory over racial discrimination and second-class citizenship at home. Black activists, supported by white allies, prominent among them being Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish clergymen, began assailing discriminatory practices, especially in the area of public accommodations. LDS church leaders dug in their heels and resisted these changes, and at the same time reinforced their long-standing racial positions with public pronouncements. The first of these public statements was made in reaction to communications between the First Presidency and the renowned Mormon sociologist Lowry Nelson, an expert on rural sociology in Cuban society. Dr. Nelson made it known to the First Presidency that he did not believe God to be a racist. There were no pure races. Mormon teachings regarding races were a product of ethnocentrism, and he expressed hope that these teachings had not become crystallized into a fixed doctrine. The First Presidency responded that Dr. Nelson allowed himself to be led astray by worldly learning. On August 17, 1949, an official statement was issued by the First Presidency declaring LDS racial teachings to be a direct commandment from the Lord. Until this time, there had never been an official First Presidency's statement on the subject of race in the priesthood. This gave the priesthood ban a canonical status that it previously lacked. A few years later, Apostle Mark E. Peterson delivered an important address on race to a convention of LDS teachers of religion at the college level in Provo, Utah. The convention was held on August 27, 1954. This address was given in reaction to the unanimous Supreme Court decision known as Brown versus Board of Education on May 14, 1954, which outlawed segregation in public schools. Mormon officials, some of whom had been prominent attorneys, knew that this decision had implications extending far beyond desegregating schools and meant fundamental changes in American society. Elder Peterson stated in his address that equality was not the main aim of African Americans. What they really wanted was absorption in the white race through intermarriage. He went on to say that none other than God had been the author of segregation. God had preserved the Jews as a separate people, and he cursed Cain and his descendants with a black skin and banned them from holding the priesthood. Faithful blacks who accepted the gospel, Peterson went on to say, would enter the celestial kingdom, but only as servants. Finally, Peterson told the assembled church educators that someday blacks would be granted the priesthood and all the blessings of the gospel. This address was published in pamphlet form and distributed among LDS religious instructors. As the decade of the 1950s continued, the winds of change began to accelerate in the United States, but the LDS leadership would follow the path of its president, David O. McKay, and quietly use its influence to oppose the burgeoning civil rights movement. Events outside the state of Utah energized the civil rights movement in the United States. Especially important was the shocking murder of teenage boy Emmett Till in Mississippi in 1955. Also important was the success of the Montgomery bus boycott featuring the courage of Rosa Parks in 1956. Civil rights now had a national attention and a zealous energy. In May 1960, the Greensboro Four showed that picketing segregated establishments was an effective way of bringing attention to problem areas. Protests developed across the United States at a host of lunch counters, beaches, libraries, movie theaters, and skating rinks where segregation existed. Utah lagged behind the rest of the country because of the reluctance of the small African-American population to get involved. One NAACP leader noted that Utah's black population had been suppressed for so long they thought it was their rightful role to be second-class citizens. They were victims of a racial prisoner of war syndrome. In spite of this reluctance to get involved, the Salt Lake Woolworth store was picketed in 1960 and again in 1963. Success was achieved when the segregated Rancho bowling lanes were integrated in 1963 as a direct result of picketing. The NAACP attempted to get the Utah legislature to pass civil rights legislation in 1963, but most legislators ignored their urgings and simply went about their business. The only tangible result from the 1963 legislative session was the repeal of the state's antiquated anti-miscegenation law, which passed with strong majorities in both houses after some debate. Utah was the second to the last state outside the South to overturn such legislation. The inability to deal with the state legislature caused NAACP leaders to seek other means to obtain civil rights. Professor J.D. Williams, a Harvard-trained political science and Mormon bishop at the time, suggested to the NAACP that the way to get things accomplished in Utah was to get the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints behind it. In the autumn of 1963, the NAACP made plans to picket the LDS General Conference. Dr. Sterling McMurrin, a philosophy professor at the University of Utah, and former U.S. Commissioner of Education in the Kennedy administration, heard of these plans and contacted Hubie Brown of the First Presidency to see if some sort of a settlement might be reached. A meeting was arranged between Brown and Eldon Tanner of the First Presidency and the NAACP leaders Albert Fritz, Dr. Charles Neighbors, and Stephen Holbrook, a former LDS missionary who had worked for Republican Congressman Sherman Lloyd. President Brown agreed to deliver a strong pro-civil rights statement at General Conference. The statement was prepared by Dr. McMurrin and was delivered by President Brown at the Sunday morning session of conference. Albert Fritz viewed this as a major victory for the NAACP and a major step in improving relations with the LDS Church. President Fritz urged all NAACP people in Utah and throughout the country to cooperate with and to not picket any of the LDS churches nor missions as was pending. The LDS Church, for its part, did not at this time view Hubie Brown's conference statement on civil rights as an official LDS Church policy statement. Federal civil rights legislation was in the works when the charismatic young President John F. Kennedy was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald in November 1963, and it was continued by the legislatively astute Lyndon B. Johnson, who succeeded Kennedy. A civil rights bill providing for the outlawing of discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, the prohibition of unequal application of voter registration requirements, and the banning of racial segregation in schools, employment, and public accommodations went into effect on July 2, 1964. A serious problem with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was that in the initial phase, powers of enforcement were weak. As a result of this, civil rights advocates in Utah wanted a Civil Rights Act in order to ensure enforcement at the state level. NAACP leaders in Utah came to believe the LDS Church was opposing the pending civil rights legislation in the Utah State Legislature. NAACP leaders John Driver, Dr. Charles Naver, and Stephen Holbrook again met with LDS First Presidency leaders Hubie Brown and N. Eldon Tanner to discuss the issue of civil rights legislation. The Mormon Church at the time was actively opposing the issue before the legislature of liquor by the drink. NAACP leaders were told by President Tanner that the church only involved itself in politics when moral issues such as the sale of liquor were involved. Dr. Neighbors pointed out to the church leaders that civil rights was a moral issue since it involved the way one human being treats another. Apparently, President Tanner also claimed he knew of no housing discrimination in Utah. Since no progress was being made with LDS Church support for the civil rights bill pending in the legislature, the NAACP set up demonstrations in front of the church office building at 47 East South Temple. Marchers and prayer vigils were held with protesters carrying signs and singing, "We Shall Overcome." As many as 350 protesters assembled at one time during the days of the protesters. At one of these demonstrations, University of Utah All-American football star Roy Jefferson stood on the steps of the church office building and bore his testimony that he and his family had experienced housing discrimination on more than one occasion. Ever mindful of damage to its public image, the LDS Church made official President Brown's 1963 pro-civil rights statement. The Utah State Legislature passed the Civil Rights Act of 1965 unanimously a few days later. The passage resulted in spite of AP and UPI reporters telling Dr. Neighbors just a few days earlier that the bill stood no chance of passing because they had counted the votes. This episode proved to NAACP leaders the overwhelming influence that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had on politics in the state of Utah. There was not only tension between the NAACP and the Mormon Church during the 1960s, but there was also a struggle within the LDS Church itself over the issue of blacks in the priesthood. The struggle centered around two strong-willed personalities, the political and social liberal, the only social and political liberal in the hierarchy, and the arch-conservative Ezra Taft Benson. President Brown believed the priesthood and temple restrictions could be terminated simply by administrative action involving a vote by members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, and he attempted to do this on more than one occasion. Each time, Brown was thwarted in his attempt by powerful conservative members of the Quorum, especially Harold B. Lee. Ezra Taft Benson, like other conservative members of the Quorum, believed blacks to be the seed of Cain, and he opposed civil rights legislation, believing it would break down racial barriers, lead to integration and eventually intermarriage and race mixing, contrary to the will of God. Benson went beyond even his conservative colleagues when he became radicalized by the extremism of the far-right John Birch Society, founded by the wealthy retired candy maker Robert Welch in 1958. In the early 1960s, Benson, under the influence of Welch, came to believe Martin Luther King and organizations like the NAACP were collaborating with Soviet agents and were seeking to destroy American democracy and capitalism. These were not just Benson's personal beliefs. He incorporated them into his sermons, speeches he often gave at conferences, firesides, and other venues. Benson also accepted the John Birch Society notion that President Dwight D. Eisenhower was a communist agent, the man he served under as Secretary of the Agriculture. Benson offended prominent Mormon politicians with these offensive ideas, as well as even conservative church authorities such as Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee. And he was sent to Frankfurt am Main, Germany, as LDS European Mission President, where it was hoped he would abandon his extreme right-wing rhetoric. Benson returned from Europe on September 14, 1965, and he proceeded to pick up where he left off. In a newsletter in 1966, the Salt Lake NAACP condemned Benson for spreading false rumors about the organization's alleged ties to communism, but the elder conservative apostle could not be stopped. Benson received permission from the ailing President McKay to address the civil rights issue at the October 1967 General Conference session, where he accused black radicals of creating a communist program for revolution in America. Deseret Book in 1968 published the conference address as a pamphlet entitled Civil Rights, a Tool of Communist Deception. When the civil rights leader Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, Benson said the martyred leader would be used by the communist conspiracy to destroy America. This led to rumors that armed black militants were preparing to attack Temple Square, a rumor that had surfaced previously on more than one occasion. At about the same time, a number of protests against Brigham Young University athletic teams erupted all over the West. The protesters felt LDS racial teachings regarding blacks were responsible for Mormon racism and discrimination. The goal was to pressure the Mormon Church into abandoning these teachings. Wishing not to be seen as bending under outside pressure, the First Presidency issued an official statement reaffirming black priesthood denial on December 15, 1969. The statement supported civil rights for all citizens and stated the seeming discrimination originated with God, was taught by Joseph Smith and all succeeding church leaders, and would someday in God's eternal plan be changed and blacks would be ordained to the priesthood. President David O. McKay passed away shortly after the First Presidency Declaration of 1969 was made, and neither of McKay's immediate successors, Joseph Fielding Smith nor Harold B. Lee, was a likely candidate to make any priesthood changes. Harold B. Lee, in fact, told his daughter he would never change priesthood policy. Lee was young as far as church presidents go, and it was expected he would be prophet for a long time. Nearly everyone expected Spencer W. Kimball to continue historical church policy regarding blacks in the priesthood when he became LDS prophet, following the unexpected early death of Harold B. Lee in December 1973. Out of a sense of loyalty, Kimball had always supported other church leaders in upholding the priesthood ban. Kimball, however, was different than other church leaders in several respects. Growing up in small-town Arizona, he had few contacts with black people, but daily contact with two other minority groups, Hispanic Americans and Native Americans. Two of Kimball's church assignments increased his ease around minority groups. In 1946, George Albert Smith called him to work with Native Americans, and in November 1963, he became chairman of the Missionary Committee. As chairman of the Missionary Committee, Kimball became convinced the Mormon message needed to be proclaimed throughout the world to all nations, tongues, and peoples. This led him to secure permission from President McKay in 1965 to begin proselytizing among millions of indigenous peoples in the Andean region of South America. Kimball also amassed a large collection of correspondence and clippings concerning the restriction aimed at blacks, and this included articles by Armand Moss and Lester Bush casting doubt on the accepted origins of black priesthood denial. Soon after becoming prophet, the LDS Church was involved with an NAACP lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America regarding discrimination against black Boy Scouts and LDS-sponsored troops. Leadership in these scout troops is determined by priesthood position of the boys, and since black youth could not hold the priesthood, the NAACP objected and filed a lawsuit. The matter was quickly dispatched with a simple change in church leadership policy. In 1975, the construction of a temple was announced for the racially mixed Brazil, where church membership was increasing at an astonishing rate. In retrospect, this seemed to set the stage for a change in church priesthood policy. In May 1975, Kimball referenced to his counselors N. Eldon Tanner and Marion G. Romney various statements by early church leaders about blacks in the priesthood, and he asked for their reactions. In June 1977, Kimball asked three general authorities, Elders Packer, Monson, and McConkie, to prepare memos on the subject of black priesthood denial. Bruce R. McConkie, who was considered a doctrinal authority, replied there was no scriptural barrier to a change in policy. The First Presidency and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles thereafter discussed the issue at length over a period of several months. A change in policy was a difficult decision for the Mormon prophet, and he felt it must be reached by a revelation. On Thursday, June 1, 1978, President Kimball asked each of the 10 available apostles what they thought of a change in priesthood policy. None was opposed. A day of Pentecost moment overtook the group. All assembled apostles thought it was a revelation from God. Even Ezra Taft Benson said, "Our bosoms burned with the righteousness of the decision we had made." President Tanner announced the decision to grant all worthy male members, regardless of race, the priesthood to the world on Friday, June 9, 1978. Declaration 2, as the revelation on the priesthood came to be known and canonized, was termed the most dramatic event of the Kimball administration and the highlight of church history in the 20th century. Directed proselytizing now occurred among African Americans in the United States. More importantly, new missions were opened in sub-Saharan Africa and in predominantly black regions of the Caribbean. Three new missions were created in Brazil between 1979 and 1985, an area where the church was experiencing explosive growth. Sterling McMurrin, who had accused the church of harboring crude racist doctrines and failing to use its considerable influence for good in the pursuit of racial equality, sent letters of congratulations to each of the members of the First Presidency for their courage in making the groundbreaking decision. President Jimmy Carter personally congratulated President Kimball via telegram. Members of the NAACP in Utah expressed mixed reactions to the revelatory announcement. One called it a nightmare rather than a revelation. When asked if he detected any change in attitude in Salt Lake following the revelation, the Reverend Francis Davis of the Calvary Baptist Church said, "Certainly not." In Davis' opinion, there was no dramatic change in attitude, not even a slight change. To Davis, the only change was that now many African Americans were being recruited to become members of the Mormon Church. Davis saw discrimination as still being a major problem in Utah. Wilford Bocage, vice president of the NAACP in Salt Lake, echoed Reverend Davis's opinions. Despite being a friend and great admirer of Reverend Davis, Dr. Charles Neighbors saw things differently. Neighbors viewed the revelation on the priesthood as having a profound effect on the community because faithful LDS church members do what their leaders tell them to do or what they perceive their leaders are telling them to do. Racial acceptance had made a quantum leap forward in Neighbors' opinion because all of a sudden the Lord had told everybody to play fair, and they'll, by God, play fair. They'll play more than fair. It remained to be seen how lasting these changes would endure and whether further changes were in store. Mormon racial teachings, after all, had not been officially altered. Elderly white men had only granted dark-skinned people priesthood rights and temple privileges. No official change had occurred in fundamental ideology. God had simply changed his mind about blacks and priesthood rights. Mormon observers were uneasy with the prospect of the crusty older conservative Ezra Taft Benson assuming the role of prophet following the death of Spencer W. Kimball. Concerns were laid to rest on November 11, 1985, when the newly appointed 86-year-old LDS president stood before reporters at a press conference and announced no new change in the direction of the church. "My heart has been filled with an overwhelming love and compassion for all members of the church and our Heavenly Father's children everywhere," Benson told the assembled reporters. And he went on to say, "I love all our Father's children of every color, creed, and political persuasion." Benson's statement indicated he was going to take a moderate stand over innovation and continuity over change. Benson affirmed he would continue the program as set forth by his predecessor. The Benson administration, the prophet being elderly, frail, and in ill health, was directed much of the time by the first counselor, the much more moderate Gordon B. Hinckley. The period saw an outreach to black Americans by the LDS Church. Church publications, which at one time had not allowed photographs of blacks on its pages, now gave exposure to inspiring stories of black conversions and progress in missions with black populations. The church joined in the celebration of Black History Month and sponsored symposia featuring black topics. Church members joined with African Americans in the celebration of Martin Luther King Day. The publication of Alex Haley's book Roots in 1976 and the subsequent blockbuster television miniseries based on the book created a keen interest in genealogy among African Americans. The LDS Church led the world in this area, providing convenient meeting ground with black Americans. Significant in this area was the microfilming of the extensive Freedmen Bank records by the church, which was begun during the Benson administration, and later the Freedmen's Bureau records were cataloged. New stakes were organized and new temples were constructed in black areas of the world. The LDS Church was making a sincere effort to relegate to the past teachings and practices that for so long had complicated relationships with black people everywhere. LDS prophets serve until death, and often they are incapacitated toward the end of their lives. This requires one of the counselors to assume a senior administrative role, such as when J. Reuben Clark directed LDS church affairs during the Heber J. Grant and George Albert Smith administrations. Gordon B. Hinckley occupied this position during the Spencer W. Kimball, Ezra Taft Benson, and Howard W. Hunter administrations. Hinckley was thus already the leading church figure when he became prophet in 1995. Possessed with an optimistic, witty, bubbly, friendly personality, Hinckley became a media favorite immediately upon becoming ecclesiastical leader. At about the same time as Gordon B. Hinckley became LDS church president, Janetta Williams succeeded Alberta Henry as president of the Salt Lake City branch of the NAACP. Born and raised in Oklahoma and educated at Idaho State University, Mrs. Williams came to Salt Lake working for U.S. West and later the Utah Transit Authority. She rose rapidly to a leadership role in the NAACP, an organization she first joined in Pocatello, Idaho. As vice president of the NAACP in Salt Lake, Mrs. Williams was instrumental in bringing the civil rights legend Rosa Parks to Utah. Rosa Parks spoke at an NAACP-sponsored event on January 20, 1992, in commemoration of Martin Luther King's birthday, an event attended by most of Utah's social, political, and religious elite. She also addressed an overflow audience of students and faculty at Brigham Young University during the celebration of Black Awareness Week on January 21, 1992. Rosa Parks also met with President Hinckley and Monson and LDS women leaders of church auxiliary organizations, Primary Young Women's and Relief Society at church headquarters. The bulk of the expenses for Rosa Parks' visit to Utah was incidentally paid for by the LDS Church and Brigham Young University. Further evidence of a more amicable relationship between the LDS Church and NAACP occurred when President Hinckley was invited to address the Western Region 1 leadership of the NAACP on April 24, 1998 in Salt Lake City. An estimated crowd of 250 delegates from the Western United States, Japan, and Korea assembled to hear the Mormon Church President Hinckley speak on the need for fathers as a pillar of strength in the family. President Hinckley expressed concern with racial prejudice in the United States, and he called for greater understanding between people of varied racial backgrounds. It matters not race. It matters not the slant of our eyes or color of our skin, Hinckley told the assembled audience. We are sons and daughters of the Almighty. He received a standing ovation at the conclusion of his address. He was presented with the NAACP Distinguished Service Award by Julian Bond, chairman of the board of directors of the NAACP. Warm and friendly relations between the LDS Church and the Salt Lake NAACP continued during the duration of the Gordon B. Hinckley administration. Several months into the administration of Thomas S. Monson, the church authorized the issuance of an official statement entitled Race in the Priesthood on December 6, 2013. Serious scholars, including Paul Reeve, Patrick Mason, Armand Moss, and the charismatic black leader Darius Gray, were consulted in constructing the official statement on race in the priesthood. In the statement, the LDS Church disavowed theories in the past that black skin was a divine curse due to failings in a premortal life, the inferiority of races, and the sinfulness of mixed-race marriages. Most welcomed the official statement with open arms. Some felt an official authority figure should have read the statement in an official venue, such as General Conference. Others believed an official apology needed to be part of the statement to make it complete. Despite these shortcomings, the church had overturned teachings held by every church president since Brigham Young. Relations between the LDS Church and the NAACP entered a new phase on Thursday, May 17, 2018, the 64th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision, when LDS President Russell M. Nelson strolled arm in arm with top NAACP officers, including Derek Johnson, the president and CEO of the NAACP. Mormon church leaders and NAACP officials met at the church administration building in Salt Lake City to demonstrate to the world greater civility, racial and ethnic harmony, and mutual respect while eliminating prejudice of all kinds. It was announced the two organizations had made plans for future joint ventures, including education and humanitarian services, disaster relief, and exterminating poverty. The genesis for this newfound cooperation occurred in far-off Mississippi, where Steve Hill, an LDS attorney, and Wilbur O. Cullum, a prominent black Mississippi lawyer and businessman, developed a close personal friendship. Wilbur Cullum introduced Steve Hill to Derek Johnson when the trio was on a humanitarian trip to Tanzania in 2010. Mr. Johnson became NAACP president in 2017 when the civil rights organization was seeking a more dynamic and activist leader, and he brought Wilbur Cullum on board as his special counsel. In that same year, LDS Apostle Jeffrey R. Holland visited the NAACP Mississippi State Office, which was Derek Johnson's home base and also the home of the martyred NAACP leader, Medgar Evers. Elder Holland noted the office was in need of repairs, and he procured funds to refurbish the NAACP office and had local missionaries and young adults make the needed repairs. This created goodwill between the LDS Church and the NAACP. Eventually, this led to the meeting between the top leaders of both organizations. In July 2018, at the National NAACP Convention held in San Antonio, Texas, Elder Jack N. Girard, an LDS 70 and head of the church's public affairs office, was invited to speak to the delegates. Elder Girard announced the organizations would provide joint training in LDS self-reliance course, training in personal finances, entrepreneurship, and seeking better jobs through education. Pilot programs were established in New Jersey, Atlanta, and Baltimore. Wilbur Cullum also addressed the convention and announced that both organizations were changing the course of their respective histories. Troubled by the racism of the Trump administration, the NAACP reached out to the LDS Church in search of cooperation, and the Mormon Church reciprocated. Since the May 2018 meeting in Salt Lake, Wilbur Cullum has been working with LDS contacts at church headquarters. The self-reliance program, which has been tailored to meet inner-city needs, has been initiated in Camden, New Jersey, a city with drug addiction problems and severe unemployment problems, under the leadership of Elder Vaisika Hema and the NAACP leader in New Jersey, Richard Smith. I hope this will be just the beginning of an important new alliance between friends, Apostle Jeffrey R. Holland stated. I think something great can proceed out of this new relationship. This seems to be the case. The new relationship seems to be flourishing. The LDS Church donated $2 million to the creation of an international African-American museum in Charleston, South Carolina. The two organizations are continuing the education and employment initiative in Chicago, San Francisco, Houston, and Charlotte, North Carolina. In May 2019, Elder Gary E. Stevenson of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles honored the NAACP for the organization's commitments to advancing equality and justice in society. At a meeting of Mormon business leaders in Washington, D.C., sponsored by the BYU Management Society, NAACP President and CEO Derek Johnson was given an award at the meeting. President Russell M. Nelson was invited to speak to the 110th National NAACP Convention held in the Cobo Center in Detroit, Michigan on July 21, 2019, the place where Martin Luther King first delivered what came to be known as the I Have a Dream speech. President Nelson was introduced as a brother from another mother, a brother from another faith tradition, and a brother from another race by the Reverend Amos Brown, the pastor of the Third Baptist Church in San Francisco, California, and a national board member of the NAACP. President Nelson did not apologize for past Mormon racism, as was hoped, but expressed to the 3,000 NAACP attendees the idea that he was there to build bridges of cooperation rather than walls of segregation. Quoting from the Book of Mormon, President Nelson told the attending NAACPers that all are alike unto God, And he expressed the hope that the NAACP and LDS Church would continue as friends and strengthen their friendship and relationship, since all are part of the same divine family. It was reported at the convention that the LDS Self-Reliance Course is achieving success beyond expectations, and it was also reported that Brigham Young University's Law School is attempting to use its large alumni lawyer network to assist people with minor legal issues in courts pro bono. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is doing all it can to improve its tarnished image in the African-American community, and it seems to be working well among members of the NAACP. That's it. Yeah.